The title of the talk is Sources of Conflict and Sources of Peace. And it's clear that we're all here for practice of some inner freedom, inner peace, inner well-being, and also spiritual growth, transformation. And yet outside, the bombs are falling, the rockets are falling, people are dying, thousands. And we're right in the middle of it. And of course we can't keep it away. So this creates questions, very legitimate questions. And I want to raise some of the questions and then talk a little bit about what we're doing here, the perspective of what we're doing here, and how that can relate to what's happening around us. I should say at the beginning that I'm not here to present any views or opinions of mine on the situation. Because if I do that, I'm just joining the whole story of believing in my views and I'm right. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to talk only about practice and about how we together can practice with this situation. So one obvious question, and I'm just going to raise a few questions that might be coming up in your minds. One obvious question is, am I escaping by coming to retreat? I'm running away. I'm making an island of peace, artificial island called a retreat. But another question is, so what's wrong with that? And maybe that's absolutely the right thing to do right now. Again, I don't have a view, but it may be the right thing or not the right thing. But it's certainly a question. Another question is the violence out there, does it challenge Dharma? In other words, is Dharma struggling? Dharma, the Buddhist teaching, the practice that we're doing, does it struggle when faced with violence? Is it a challenge to the Dharma? Or is the opposite true, that the Dharma is one of the only places that we can come to understand and deal with violence? It can be the opposite, and it's a question that we can feel inside. Another obvious question is, so are we developing tools in this practice with which to cope with violence? And if so, what are the tools that we are developing right here that will help us to meet violence and maybe help other people to reduce violence? And another question, what is the sources of violence? And what are the sources of peace? What's the roots of violence? And what's the root of peace? And finally, something very personal. What do we do with all the confusions and feelings of helplessness and feelings of fear and feelings of anger and feelings of despair and of sadness that we all absorbing in these times? What do we do with them? Where do we put them? How do we deal with them? It seems that that many of us might feel a kind of mismatch, ihatama, between the goodness in our heart, which I'm sure everyone here has a heart full of goodness. We will all help a blind person in the road. Not one person here would not do that. And maybe 99% of the population, never mind which population, would help a blind person cross the road. Something very deep in us is the goodness which we have. It's a fundamental goodness. But we feel that the goodness is meeting a very messy world. And that's the problem. The goodness in our heart meets a really hard world, day by day. And there is a source of many of our questions and feelings and confusions. We all hate violence. No one wants violence. But it's there all over. And I think that we are challenged by the fact that we can't say it's just them that are doing harm. Because we are, as human beings, sharing the same mind and the same being. It's not that we are perfect and others are doing the violence and making conflict. We actually share it. We are belonging to the human species. We are affected by conditioning. And it becomes much more difficult because we share some of those views, feelings that are making violence. They're also in us. I give an example. We have a desire for peace. We have a desire for protection. We have a desire for safety. We have a desire, basically, for not to be disturbed. We want to go on holiday. We want to be left alone. We don't want them there throwing rockets on us. But this is a desire. It means that we're part of the same story. That we have a desire to stop them. Or we have a desire to get away, or we are busy pushing away them, or others, or situations. So the desire is partly what everybody feels. Most wars in the world have been fought in the name of peace. It's the slogan of almost every war. We're fighting this war for peace. Desire for peace can bring war. So clearly it's a problem. The negative side, aversion or slida or not wanting, fear, anger, hate. This is human. We are human beings. We share these. We maybe get up in the morning, we open newspaper, and we share those feelings. So we're not so separate and pure. Or ignorance, aversion. Ignorance is borut. And often in the Dharma sense, ignorance is separation. The sense that we are separate from them. The sense of labeling them and us. The sense of them against us. And the view in there that they are against us. And we are right, and so on. So these basically are called the three poisons in the Buddhist tradition, of the poison of greed or wanting, desire, and the poison of negativity, hating, fear, anger, etc., and the poison of ignorance. And they're the three poisons that keep the whole world of samsara turning, keep the whole world of suffering going round and round. And what they do is these poisons generate a lot of thinking. They generate lots and lots of thinking, any of them. And we think our way through them. The thoughts go round and round and round and round. And the tendencies we have of these tendencies and all the thoughts that go with them, they lead in the end to violence. And so I want to give a quote from a Buddhist text, which really explains. Someone asked the Buddha, how is it that people end up using weapons against each other. Fights, quarrels, dispute, blaming, hate, and false speech. And the Buddha said, that the source is perceptions and ideas or notions in the mind, which are colored by lots of thinking. If nothing is there, is found there to delight in, to welcome and hold on to, in other words, if we don't hold on to perceptions and ideas that create lots of thinking, then it's the end of the tendency to desire, of the tendency to anger or hate, of the tendency to have views and believe them, of the tendency to confusion, of the underlying tendency to be full of myself and me, of the tendency to survivalism, desire for wanting to be alive and survive, pushing for survival, of the tendency to ignorance. And this is the end of using weapons of quarrels and fights and conflict. And here these unhealthy states of mind, they stop. So the Buddha is saying it all comes from perceptions that we see and hear with our senses, creating lots of thinking, and then the thinking moving to support tendencies, nityot, of views, desires, survivalism, fears, etc., etc. So what the Buddha is saying is the problem is not that we have a good compassionate heart and the world is messy. The Buddha is saying we have a compassionate heart and our mind is messy. And that's the problem. It's not the mess isn't out there in life. The mess is here, in here. And the compassionate heart meeting that mess creates the confusions and the difficulties for us. These tendencies that that the Buddha talks about are very deep, are very powerful. I mean, just thinking sometimes, how is it that everybody suffers now 100 years in this area of the world with a conflict that nobody can solve? And two peoples living next to each other just can't, nobody, not the professors, and not the priests, and not the rabbis, and not the imams, and not the poets, and not the artists, and not the politicians for sure. And nobody can solve the problem. And yet both so much suffering, and so little result from the suffering. So any child will look and say, what are you doing? Can't you stop this? 100 years been going. So it's clearly very deep. It's not something that you can just get up in the morning and say, no, we'll stop it. It's 100 years since the First World War. And I'm interested in this aspect of history. And I've been reading quite a lot about it. And the First World War started from the most stupid reasons. There are just no reasons at all. And it was the most devastating war that you could imagine. Devastating, with millions of people dying in a terrible way. And no reason. Nobody, just because of ego of generals that said, well, they might attack us in the future, so maybe we will attack them first. Because in the future, anyway, we'll have to fight, so let's fight now, rather than wait. That's what the... And crazy empire egos, of imperial egos of kings and generals, and leading unstoppable devastation, and no reason. And when it finished, nobody could understand why we fought this war that devastated most of Europe. Nobody could really understand it. Who gained from this? Nobody. So you have to look at it a bit more deeply and look at the mind that does this. And it's not just now. The Buddha also, the depth of this issue was at the Buddha's time. There were a bunch of his own monks that were completely fighting with each other about small issues of internal laws that they have, the Vinaya of how monks should behave. And there were, we even know all this from the Jewish world, how everyone's fighting everyone else about small differences in how to behave and what are the mitzvot. But then too. And the Buddha couldn't solve it. And the monks in this particular case were just fighting and fighting and fighting. And the Buddha said, I can't deal with you guys, it's just too much. And he went away. And he said, I'd much rather sit in the forest. And by the way, when he went to the forest, there he met an elephant. And the elephant was walking through the forest. And they could understand each other. And the Buddha said, why, I know you're here for the same reason. That your crowd of elephants are just fighting each other and you just want to get away. So we're together. We're. All of this is to show how deep these tendencies are, for us also not to feel a little bit humble, because we have them as well. We cannot say it's others. And a lot of the reason that it's so difficult is because it's a process of conditioning, hatnaya, which we don't have control over. We can't stop being conditioned, being shaped by our experiences. We just can't stop it. We can't put ourselves in a box from the age of zero and say, no, we're not going to have any of that stuff coming in. No parent can do that with a child. The child wouldn't survive. We are open beings, ready to be conditioned, formed by karma, shaped. And nothing we can do about that. I can't say, stop, I don't want to become Stephen. I can turn that around and say, it's great that I'm Stephen. It's happened, so that's it. I've got a form called Stephen. But I can't stop it. Or control it. And the violence is a bit like that. It's a process of conditioning that happens. And everyone's caught in it. The Buddha was once called to try and solve conflict between two peoples who were fighting and killing each other. And he said, why are you fighting? And they said, we don't know. Fight has been going on for years. Go and ask them. So he went off to ask other people, why are you fighting? That we don't know. We've just been fighting for a long time. It's just happening. And he went back and he said, why are you fighting? And he kept asking and asking. And eventually he found that the whole thing started from two groups of farmers that were fighting over water in a river. That they wanted, each one wanted more water from the river. And the Buddha talked to them and said, don't you think that the blood in your veins, the orakim, is more precious than the water in the river? And that ended the fight. The Dharma practice that we're doing takes this conditioned mind with all its tendencies of greed, hate, and delusion and looks at the mess directly. The big shift that happens in this retreat and in our life in the Dharma is not to run away from that mess of conditioning, but to turn ourselves towards it and meet it as it is, And that changes everything, because we begin to take responsibility for the mess in the mind. And we become, in a sense, different from that. We don't project things into the world in an automatic way. We take responsibility for our own minds. There is a famous Indian story about this, about a king that wanted to wash in the river, in the ocean. And he said, so, I don't want to walk on the dirty ground. Please cover the ground with leather, so that I can walk on the leather to go and wash in the sea, to purify myself. And they killed all the cows in the kingdom, and made leather carpet for him to walk. But they didn't have enough leather, so they got stuck. So they asked the man, old man, wise man, what do we do? The king needs to walk to the sea without touching the ground and getting dirty. And he said, oh, well, why don't you take a small piece of leather and make some shoes? And it's a bit like that. We project out in the world. We want to sort the world out, but we can sort ourselves out first, and then things get a lot easier. This is a very empowering process. The Buddha talked about this movement of taking responsibility for our mind through seeing our mind and staying steady in the source of all the issues that we have. He called it the roar of the lion. He said that anybody that does this in a way becomes a lion. This is not, this sitting quietly is not withdrawing and becoming a mouse and becoming shy and quiet and withdrawn and shut away, kind of gentle meditators disappearing from life. It's a lion. It's a lion's roar, because it's not easy to look at our mind. We're just usually just, it's doing us. It's controlling us. So in a way, we get a huge power from turning to look at our mind and turning to look at the mess and staying steady in the eye of the storm, ena sera. And we get a huge power from this. We become master rather than slave of the mind. The Buddha also says, any practitioners of the Dharma are like kings or Brahmins. He changed the meaning of the word Brahmin from a religious Hindu meaning to meaning nobility. So, this is a shift in the view, and conflict, violence, is now we can see an opportunity to show us ourselves. It's not something that we can ever run away from and avoid and not be part of. But it tells us where we have to look. It tells us something about ourselves. It's where we have to practice. It's a challenge to us to say, okay, stop and look. So, there's two basic directions. One is what you've already heard about a little this morning. Yonatan was talking about mindfulness of the breathing. And mindfulness is simply awareness. Because we can't look at our minds if we're asleep. We need to awake. We need to have the power of mind to be able to look at our life. To stand there and say, I'm ready to turn around and see who I am. And that needs a power of mind. That needs some wakefulness. And it's exactly what we're practicing. Mindfulness is a power. It may seem a little bit weird. What? The breath? I have to look at the breath? It's not that interesting. I have to look at how the foot touches the ground. It's rather boring. It's just like, well, what's this? This is not philosophy, and this is not ecstasy, and this is not spirituality, and it's just the foot touching the ground. My body, I know my body. Why do I have to look at my body? But it's not like that. Mindfulness is a power. It's a tool that we develop. And I was actually giving instruction this morning, mentioning as we walked how much we are locked in here and how much when we expand the awareness through our body, we're already expanding the horizon of our awareness. We're already expanding the power of our awareness into the body. But we forgot. We forgot what it's like to walk. We forgot what it's like to breathe. We forgot what it's like to feel the breeze on the skin, on the cheeks. We forgot. Because we were all collected ourselves into this mind which says, I need this and I need that and I need to do this and I need to go there and that's chaseli then and interests and inyanim. So mindfulness is a way of learning intimacy. Intimacy with ourselves, and from intimacy with ourselves we can begin to go out to intimacy with the world. It's not that we are locked in ourselves. We are also in the world. But we start expanding the boundary of our awareness. Vipassana, the word vipassana, is to see things clearly. To be clear. V is to see into. Vipassana is to see, sight. So insight, tovana, this is why we call ourselves tovana, is the translation of vipassana. So we're seeing the way things are. And the way things are, by the way, what really helps us is the way things are, is that they pass and they pass by. So our mind, we look at our mind, but it's not made of concrete. It's dynamic, it's changing, it's flowing. There's a freedom in the mind too. And that's vipassana. It shows us not only our mind, but it shows us that our mind is actually free. Not as stuck as we thought. One of the keys to understanding and helping to solve conflict in the world is this relationship between the inner and the outer. If we clearly see our mind, we also see the world. If we're intimate with our own body, we'll be intimate with the birds, the sound of the birds and the trees and the grass, and we'll be intimate with others. And we'll see their issues, we'll see their pain, we'll see their life. And this is fundamental practice. Shantideva said, it's holy. It's kadosh, it's holy. To put yourself in the shoes of another, of the other, is sacred. We have to look at our own shoes, put ourselves in our own life, and then we can put ourselves in others' life. And see the other, another, and the whole world around us. The two are not separate. Inner and outer go together. And we'll be discovering this in these days together. In the Dhammapada, it says, having empathy for others, one sees that all beings love life, and they all fear death. Knowing this, one cannot cause harm to anybody. So the basis of non-violence, of stopping violence, is the sense, the knowing that others are like us, and knowing the other to be just like us. attitudes are helpful in mindfulness, as we heard this morning, the attitude of being a friend of whatever arises. When we look at our own mind and the mess, we may be rather upset. We may think, my God, this is me. I'm sure many of you are sitting here thinking, my God, I never realized what a catastrophe is going on inside. And it's a shock sometimes. There's so much noise in the mind, or there's so much stuff going around, or there's so much. I never realized how much I'm criticizing myself all the time, for example. Self-judgment. I'm judging myself. I never realized. So we get a shock sometimes. The movement of being friend of ourselves and a friend of anything that arises is important, is part of the compassion. We don't fight ourselves. We embrace whatever is arising. It is us. They are the guests, the visitors that arise from our conditioning. The guests that arise, the thoughts that arise, the tendencies that we have, they are our guests. We don't fight them. And as we do this, and as we look at ourselves, moment by moment, we may see, it's like a river, we're like a river. We're like a sea, or a river. Things move past. Every guest that arises also leaves. Every moment is just preparing ourselves for another moment. Every visitor in the mind comes and goes. Every tendency that we have is only there for a moment. As soon as we can be in the most difficult loop in the mind, and as soon as the bell rings, whoop, gone. Where did it go? And maybe we can get a hint. If it goes when the bell rings at the end of a sitting, maybe it wasn't really mine in the first place. Maybe it was a visitor that comes and goes. Maybe it's not really mine. And it's an insight, definitely it's an insight that we should pay attention to. Do we really own this, all this stuff? Or is it just stuff that's come into us? Is it me? Is it mine? One of the keys to peace is the ability to let go. Let go of stuff that arises. Let go of things that we think are ours, me. Ajahn Chah said, if we let go a little, we have a little peace. If we let go a lot, we will have a lot of peace. If we let go completely, we will have complete peace. And our struggles with life will come to an end. But this issue of peace, it's not an easy one. We have lots of perceptions of being peaceful. Some of those perceptions are to do with, indeed, finding a peaceful place. We enter a retreat, and we think, I must come to retreat. It's so important. I have to come to retreat. I have to find some peace from the craziness of life. In other words, we are creating conditions where we think peace. We will find peace. But it's not so simple, because what tends to happen is we go to a retreat to look for peace, and then we meet our minds. And that's the end of the peace. And we meet our crazy minds and we think, my God, I want to leave this retreat. This is not working. I meant to come here to find peace, and all I've found is a huge noise inside me. So indeed, some stopping is helpful. Just to stop and sit, it is helpful. It is changing the conditions, and the conditions changing do help us. There is a story about that, a Zen story, about a student that was running to his teacher and exhausted and stressed. And the teacher said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "I'm running away from my shadow." Hatzel Shelley. And the teacher said, "Oh, that's it? Any other problems?" He said, "Yes, I'm running away from my footsteps." Ekvot. So the teacher said, "Okay, I've got a solution for you. Sit under a tree, no shadow, and no footsteps." So a little bit we are doing that. In other words, we're creating conditions where we stop. And this is helpful. But that's very much just the beginning. It really is just the beginning. And the real work is understanding more deeply what is peace. Peace is not about shutting down, shutting ourselves down, anesthesia, closing the heart, closing the mind. Even though some people think that that's what meditation is, that's not it at all. I remember reading a little picture in a magazine, a Buddhist magazine, about a woman that was sitting in meditation, and she was sweating, and she was struggling, and there were, in the picture, there were balloons about her thoughts, like, "Oh, I didn't do this, and oh, I have to do that, and oh, I was like that, oh, I'm no good at this, and people are angry with me about that, I should have done that, and I'm on for 1 hour sitting." And at the end of it, the teacher came and said, "Wasn't that relaxing, my dear?" It's not shutting things down, peace. And peace is not also not getting what we want. We think it is. We think, if I just get what I want, then everything will be peaceful. If I just stop the disturbance from there, then everything will be peaceful. If I just stop the rockets, then everyone will be peaceful. If I just, change the situation and get all the money I need and my job and my this and have a better job and a better life, but then I find peace. But it doesn't work like that. That's just temporary. And then the whole thing carries on. Because it's here, it's not there. And peace isn't about wanting peace. We don't get peace from wanting peace. We just have wanting. And that's not peaceful at all. And don't forget what I said before, that most wars in the world have fought in the name of peace. So wanting peace isn't peace. Peace, as you know in Hebrew, is closer to shalem, shlemut. There's something in the whole. It's something about being with that is the essence of peace. If there is less gap and separation between us and the world, peace happens by itself. We are here and the world is there and there's a separation and we project into the world our desires, our greed, hate, and delusion. Our desires, our needs, our interests, and that model cannot bring peace. The model of intimacy brings peace, where the world and us are one, so we cannot be disturbed. Who can disturb whom? Where can we be disturbed if the world and us are together? There's a sense of belonging, a deep belonging, a sense of completion. We can still have unpleasant experiences. We can still feel the back hurts and the mind hurts, and but underneath the basis, this togetherness of us and the world is the nature of peace. There's nothing to be disturbed. There's no, who is disturbing who? What is disturbing what? So that's the movement towards peace, is the movement of completion, of shleimut. So we can let go a little bit of the need to control things, let go of the need to manipulate, to fix things, let go of desire for things to be in a certain way, let go of our angers and aversions that things shouldn't be like that. I remember the last retreat we had in July here, there was a Friday and it was the end of the Ramadan, the festival, and there was a morning meditation at 6:30, and the muezzin and the imam, whatever, was talking through such loud, because they're ramkolim from the village nearby, and the whole room was filled with kazeh, sort of shouting, and no one understood what he was saying, and everyone was upset. I was trying to say, wait a minute, just look at it. This is a very, very good example. Someone took your peace away. How is that possible? Look and see how it happened. Disturbance is an invitation to look. We can be in the eye of the storm, Ein Hasera, and it's a place to be, not to shut down the storm, not to get rid of it, not to close the door to life, but to be connected to life, intimate with life, and there is peace. So, with these kind of tools that we are learning here, we will have answers to those questions that I mentioned at the beginning. We will understand more the sources of peace, the sources of violence. We will understand more how we are affected by the same voices that others are affected. We're not separate from others. And we will have more sense of what to do with that stuff. We'll have more mastery over our own minds. And we will be able to go out into the world and be effective at reducing conflict. Because it's exactly those kind of tools that we're learning here, of steadiness, of awareness, of being able to be in the eye of the storm, of being master of our own minds and not slaves, of understanding how we're formed, the conditioning, of understanding others, of knowing the pain of others, and knowing the pain of ourselves, and therefore having genuine compassion, and knowing genuine peace. How can we expect others to be peaceful if peace is not even known what it is? And if we have a real deep knowledge of what is peace, then we can bring peace. If we don't know peace ourselves, how can we bring peace to anybody? So we are learning these tools here which are helpful for us and helpful for others. And so I think actually this is the best activism that you can imagine. And we're really activists here in a certain way, because we are learning tools that we bring into life. And many, 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 many generations of people have been learning these same tools and have been going out and making peace in the world. So I want to finish with just a small image from the Dhammapada. Dhammapada is a book of kind of just small poems, which is collected from generations of Buddhist literature. And there was a very nice little phrase about how we go through life using these tools. And it says, as a bee is collecting nectar. Nectar is a tsuf. A bee gathers nectar, but does not harm and does not disturb the color and the aroma of the flower, so the wise move through this world. It's a beautiful image of how we move through this world. So let's take a couple of minutes of quietness together.